This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Today was Parshat HaChodesh, where we learnt what is in essence the first mitzvah given to the people of Israel as a nation. HaChodesh HaZeh Rosh Chodashim, that Nisan should be considered the first month of the year. And in particular we learned from this mitzvah the dinim of Rosh Chodesh, and Kiddush HaChodesh, and Hebrews, leap years, and so on and so forth. In essence, what the Ibn Ezra points out is that this mitzvah constitutes a move from a solar calendar to a lunar calendar. It constitutes a move from a solar identification, in a sense, to a lunar identification. There's a tremendous significance on every level to the lunar calendar system, halachically, philosophically, emotionally. I want to just try and understand a little bit about what the moon represents to us. We've talked about it on a number of occasions before, but I'm going to take a slightly different angle. What the moon represents to us, what the moon means to us, what Rosh Chodesh means to us, and why we're so fascinated with the moon, because we are, as a nation, we're extremely fascinated with the moon. The moon is important not only halachically, but poetically one finds tremendous reference made to the moon. And altogether the moon adopts a particularly important place in Jewish thinking. What is the moon? There are two references to the moon that I want to base this on. The first is a reference in Shir HaShirim, in the 6th chapter of Shir HaShirim, where the Pasuk says, in praising Knesset Israel, in praising the people of Israel, the Tanakh says, Yofo kalavana ubara kechama. The people are as beautiful as the moon and as clear as the sun. Understand the concept of the clarity of the sun. Sure, the sun is clear. When the sun is shining, you can see your way around. When the sun is not shining, it's dark and it's difficult to see where you're going. It's confusing. But what is this concept of Yofo Kalavana, as beautiful as the moon? As if the moon is the epitome of beauty. One would think if Shir HaShirim, which is a song that concerns itself so much with beauty, is looking for an image of beauty, one could find things more beautiful than the moon to compare the people of Israel to. But it seems not. It seems there's an element of beauty that the Levana has, that the moon has, which is unique and which is meant to be emulated by the people of Israel. The second reference is a reference to the Gemara in Chulin, that Samach Amud Beis, 60b, which I think I've done before in this year. It might have been in the Chumash year that we did it before. But I do it in this year, the one about the sun and the moon. It was in the Chumash year, wasn't in the Matzah Shabbos year. I'm not going to go into the Gemara in detail, but just one aspect of it. Alan, was it in this year or in the Chumash year? Possibly. The famous Gemara, which is actually very often misunderstood. The Gemara asks the contradiction in the beginning of the Torah, where once it refers to the two big lights, and then in another place it refers to the big light and the little light. The Gemara tells the following background story. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi asks, it says, and God made the two big lights. It says the big light and the small light. The moon said to the Ribbono Shel Olam. In other words, Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi is assuming that initially the sun and the moon were created equally powerful, of equal size. Ribbono Shel Olam, efshal lishnei malachim sheyishtamshu beketer echad? Is it possible for two kings to use the same crown? Says the moon. Omar lo. So the Ribbono Shel Olam says to her, Lechi umati et atzmech. Go and make yourself small. Okay, two kings can't share the same crown, so you serve the other king, that's all. At this point, our sympathy is with the sun. Our sympathy is not with the moon.
And the Torah Tumimah in fact wants to explain another pasuk, where another pasuk, a statement in the Gemara, which is actually brought lahalacha, that if a person is insulted and doesn't react, he fulfills the concept of the pasuk va'ayak tzeis hashemesh b'gvulosay, and it will be as the sun comes out in all its strength. And he asks, what's that got to do with the sun? What does it mean if you listen to an insult and you don't answer, what's that got to do with the sun? And he brings this Gemara. And he says, the same as the sun kept quiet, the moon was the one that complained, the sun didn't say anything. So if a person is insulted and doesn't say anything, that's very good. At this point, that's how we understand it. So the Rebbeinu Shalom punishes the moon, so to say, and says, make yourself small. Amra lefanav, she said to him, Rebbeinu Shalom, hoyel v'amati lefanecha dover hogun. And he said, amit yasatsmi. You don't say that what I said is wrong. You accept that what I said is right, so I bring up a valid point and I've got to suffer. Amar lo lechiyu meshul b'yom v'layla, leave me alone, girl, to compensate you can be around in the day and the night. The sun is only around in the night time, and you can be around in the day and the night. Amar lo lechiyu meshul b'yom v'layla, so she said to him, what's the good of that? Amar lo lechiyu meshul b'yom v'layla, maya hami, what's the point of a candle in the daylight? Can you see anything with a candle in the daylight? Does it add any more light? If there's a sun, you don't need any more light. The Jews will use you as a calendar. Maybe that will satisfy you. She says the moon, but the sun they're going to use as well, because they work out the tikufos by using the sun. The festivals have to fall in certain specific seasons, so although they'll use a lunar calendar, the sun's also involved. Wherever I am, the sun is. I want an area which is only mine. Zil likru tzaddiki b'shmech. So the Rebbeinu Shalom, tzaddikim will use you as an example, and this is the important part for this purpose of this year. Yaakov hakotan, that psukim which talk about the little Yaakov. Shmuel hakotan, David hakotan. So we see now that another midah of the moon is katnus. It's the ability to be small, which the Rebbeinu Shalom is praising. The fact that you, moon, were able to make yourself small is something which Jews will ultimately regard as a midah towards which to strive. So she complains about that and says that's also no good. And eventually the Gemara concludes that the Ribbono Shalom actually brings a korban, so to say. The Rosh Chodesh korban which we bring is a korban chatas, and it says a korban chatas la Hashem, and the Gemara learns out of that. It's so to say as if the Ribbono Shalom is saying to the people of Israel, bring a korban chatas, bring a sin offering because of what I did to the moon. In other words, the Ribbono Shalom is almost saying at the end, although I had to do that to the moon, it's a pity in a sense, and our sympathy starts moving from the sun back to the moon. Because nowhere is she criticized. On the contrary, the Ribbono Shalom tries to compensate her as far as he can for having to make her small. Be that as it may, the only point that I want to bring from here is the midah of katnus, the fact that one of the things we seem to be meant to learn from the moon is its ability to make itself small. The other is its beauty. And it's the relationship between these two concepts, or these two descriptions of the moon, its smallness on the one hand, and its beauty on the other hand, that I want to examine. What does it mean that the moon is smaller than the sun? I don't think it's a question of size, because obviously the moon would have to be smaller. If there was going to be night, as there was going to be, and the moon was going to be in the night time, then obviously it would have to be fairly dark when the moon was around. So it would appear that even initially the moon was going to give less light than the sun was going to give. But what might be is that the moon was initially going to be a source of light, the same as the sun. A source of energy, not merely a reflector of energy. Whereas after this story in the Gemara, the moon becomes simply a reflector of the sun's light. The moon asks, how can two kings reign? How can you have two kinds of sunlight in the world? Answers the Rebbeinu Shalom, you're right, you can only have one. You will simply reflect the light of the sun, but you won't be a sun on its own. Reflectiveness, if there is such a word, is actually the essence of beauty. Because you can't regard the sun as beautiful. You can't look at the sun. In order for something to be beautiful, that means that you look at it and take pleasure in looking at it. The sun you can't look at and take any kind of pleasure in looking at it. As important as sun rays are, and as important as sunshine is, there's no beauty to the sun. Any source of light, a light bulb, you don't sit and look at a source of light and admire its beauty. It can in fact be harmful to do that. The only way you can admire the beauty of light is by seeing its reflection, seeing the way it creates colors on the various things, on the various textures, on the various materials onto which it shines. That's the only way you can appreciate the beauty of Torah. What is it in fact that you're appreciating? When the Shir HaShirim talks about Yafa Kalvana, as beautiful as the moon. What is the beauty? Does the moon simply enable us to appreciate the beauty of the sun? Or are we actually appreciating the beauty of the moon when we look at it? Actually both. Because the beauty of color, or of any form of reflection, is a peculiar reflection created by a specific type of light on a specific reflector, on a specific material. Take any two different materials and put them in the same light, and they look different. Take the same material and put them in two different lights, and they look different. What we see when we look around at the world and we admire beauty, we can only admire beauty in terms of the light it reflects to us. That's what aesthetics is. Aesthetics is simply a visual experience, and its visual experience means that we are being sensitive to the light which the object reflects of itself, light which is beamed at it from some source, whether it's the sun or some artificial source. This concept in fact was highlighted by the Impressionists, who started moving away from simply painting form and started painting the light effects more than anything else. Who was it who painted the Rome Cathedral? Remember those four? Who was that? I can't remember who it was. The best example of that is the Impressionist artist, whose name I've forgotten, who came up with a very simple idea, and he said, what do? We take sunlight and we paint different things. So we paint a flower in the sunlight, and we paint a lake in the sunlight, and we paint a swan in the sunlight. He says, you're taking different things and showing how they reflect light in different ways. Why not take the same thing and paint it at different times of the day? To show how the same thing reflects light in a different way at different times of the day. And he, in fact, painted the Rome Cathedral, four paintings, which form a certain, very beautiful. One done in the early morning, one done in the late morning, one done early afternoon, and one done in the late afternoon. And you see, what he's trying to paint is not the form of the cathedral, because in any case, the Impressionist artists were moving away from form. And they were going toward light reflection. And he showed that you've got to, not only is it important what you're painting, but in what light you're painting. So beauty can only be noted. Beauty can only be observed. If you throw light on truth, if there's no light, there's no beauty. It's dark, it's black, there's nothing. Beauty can only be observed when you throw a specific light onto a specific object and you see the response from the object, the way the object reflects. How much light it absorbs, how much light it reflects. The type of light it reflects, the color of light it results. We've talked a lot over the last couple of weeks about internalization. And you've got the same concept here in an aesthetic sense. A material which reflects everything. This isn't particularly pretty, it's ostentatious. There's no beauty to a mirror. There's no beauty to shiny chrome or shiny silver. It's not beautiful. A material which doesn't reflect light at all, which is just black, is not beautiful. Somewhere in between those ranges is where there's beauty. Silver, which is not shiny, but is a little bit matted, is beautiful. Black, which is not quite black, but a greyish black, begins to become beautiful, or can begin to become beautiful. But something which is totally reflective or totally absorbent isn't so beautiful. And the uniqueness of each material is in exactly where it lies in the scale between black and silver, black and mirror, as well as the type of light being laid onto it. You have people who reflect. You have people who, when you look at them, you just get back what you give them. That's it. They're mimics. Nothing is really theirs. They dress the way they're taught to dress. They talk the way they're taught to talk. They tell you what they've been told to tell you. They think what everybody else thinks. That's one kind of person. You've got another kind of person who you can't communicate with at all. He just listens. He hears and he talks and talks and it all goes in. And he reads and it all goes in. Nothing comes up. Nothing's reflected at all. And then you have the people in between. You have the loud, ostentatious, tinny person, and you have the still avatars, and you have the people in between who you give something to and it comes back to you. But it doesn't come back exactly as you gave it to you. That would be a mirror. It comes back different. When you look at the way sunlight is reflected off a green leaf, doesn't come back to you the same way as the sunlight was given to you. It absorbs part and it gives back another part in a different form. It's sunlight that you're seeing. If you hold a leaf out in the light and you look at the color green, it's sunlight that you're seeing, but it's not the same as when you look at the sun. It's the particular sunlight formed by that particular object's reflection. And so with any other object that you care to look at, is the particular light it is able to give back to you when light is beamed onto it. So you have people, as we've mentioned in the last couple of shiurim, who listen to a shiur and be able to repeat it to you verbatim. That's the mirror kind of person. You have the kind of person who listens to a shiur and can't repeat it at all. That's the black kind of person. Not racially, but just conceptually. And then you have the kind of person who can repeat it to you, and it's different. It's the same thing, it's the same concept, but it's theirs. It comes over as something new, comes over as something fresh. If you want to test the beauty of a person, surprise them. When you were planning to go out to the movies one evening, after not having been out alone with your wife for many, many years, bring home 10 guests for dinner that night, 5 minutes before dinner. And see what happens. Don't do it too often.
Twice
is too much. Twice is too much. But once it's interesting. Because what you're doing then is you're testing beauty. You're throwing a beam of light and you're watching a response. And you'll be surprised. You'll be surprised, I'm sitting here talking to the men, at the kind of beauty that such a situation can respond. You might get a jolly good hiding later when the visitors have gone, but you'll be surprised at the extent, at the surprise in another person's beauty, a person that one knows even, when one surprises them with a beam of light, and you watch what comes back. Of course, it doesn't have to be surprise. Any reaction, any response, even if it's a reasoned response, even if it's a thought-out response, as long as it's not contrived, as long as it's basically natural, is a reflection of beauty. If you want to see how beautiful a person is, don't ask them their opinions on the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. It doesn't mean anything. Throw a beam of light at them and see what comes back. Challenge them with something. Put something onto them and see what comes back. Sometimes nothing will come back, and then you're with a black person. Sometimes everything comes back, and then you're living with a mirror. But what usually happens is that it comes back in a disguised form. It comes back in a way that you didn't expect. It comes back in a way where you've got elements, mixtures, blends, that isn't what you threw at the person and isn't something totally different. The Ribbono Shel Olam does it too. He's constantly measuring our beauty by subjecting us to beams of light. Sometimes those beams of light are heavy and they burn. Then you just have to know to reflect more of it away so that it doesn't hurt you. Sometimes they're tender, they're soft. And you have to know to reduce the reflection and to absorb some of the warmth. Sometimes one has things thrown at one that one doesn't even know whether one can handle. One can handle it. What the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to see is the response, the reaction. What happens when I throw this at you? What do? You just take it and don't react at all? You just throw it back? Or do you absorb it and give me back something quite unexpected? That's the whole concept of the Nisoyon, of what has been badly translated as a trial. The Ribbono Shel Olam is constantly putting us into situations to test our beauty. If you want to buy a new object, if you want to buy a new piece of furniture or a painting, you put it in different lights. You try it in daylight, you try it in artificial light, you try it with fluorescent light, you try it with light directly on it, you try it with light indirectly on it. To see what kind of an object it is, because you can look at something in one kind of light and you put it in another light and it's totally different. And our whole lives are processes of moving from exposure in one type of light to exposure into another type of life. It's the same human being, and the Ribbono Shel Olam constantly bombarding us with different types of light, watching the reactions that come. One would think that this is in itself the essence of the other aspect of the moon. The moon is reflective. The only way we can look at the sun's light is by looking at the moon. One would think that that's the catalyst of the moon as well. That's the modesty of the moon as well. To know that I have nothing of my own. Whatever I've got is reflected from you, O sun. And we think that that is the essence of modesty. To know I have nothing. Whatever I've got is a reflection from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's it. I can't create anything on my own. I can't generate anything on my own. All I can do is, if I've learned something and I've heard something, I can mix them together and come out with a new blend. I've got a thought here and I've got a thought there, and I saw something somewhere else, I can mix them together, I can analyze them, put them together in a different way, and put them out. I can simply take the things that are thrown at me and throw them back in a slightly different form after they've mingled with my own personality. But if I don't have any input, if the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't give me anything, I haven't got anything. If the Ribbono Shel Olam gives me money, I can give charity. But if he doesn't give me money, I can't. If the Ribbono Shel Olam gives me the opportunity to learn Torah, I can teach Torah. But if I haven't learned Torah, I can't teach Torah. If I've heard something, I can talk about something. But if I haven't heard anything, I can't talk about anything. That's why deaf people usually have difficulty in speaking. One would think that's the essence of another. One would think that's the essence of modesty. Just to know that I've got nothing on my own. Whatever I've got is a reflection of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let's leave it there for a moment and we'll come back in a second. It's amazing. I'm sure you've all experienced it yourselves. I certainly have very frequently. How after reaching heights, how quickly one can fall to depths that you absolutely shock yourself at being capable of falling to. The speed with which it can happen is what's striking. A slow deterioration, you then come to a shiur for 6 weeks, and you then go to davening for 6 weeks, and your davening starts deteriorating, and your learning starts deteriorating, and after 6 weeks you're not quite the same guy as you were 6 weeks before. And I can understand. But you can have a situation where it's Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur, you're an angel, and when you're davening Ma'ariv, you're worse than you were the 2 nights before. You don't know how you could get back to having me. An animal. Just like that, in 1 minute. But you can have a situation where you hear a fantastic shiur and you're elevated to levels, and you come out and you run your life just the way you did before, right down to where you were before. One can have an incredible Shabbos where you've sat and you've learnt and you've talked in Torah and you've sung mirrors and you've eaten meals together, and there hasn't been a word of talk that there shouldn't have been, and there hasn't been any kind of aveira, whatever. It's been an atmosphere of kedusha and tahara, and one's been part of it. Shabbos is out, you have to move. It's unbelievable the speed with which these falls can occur. And what's worse than that is the despair that follows. It's almost as if the reaching the height was wasted. Because then you look at yourself after you've fallen and you say, oh, what's it all about? What's the difference with me? Who cares? And one loses hope, one loses confidence. There are a few examples of this in the Chumash. The one is Cain, before what happened, was really a very great man. One has to have the right view of Cain. He was a prophet. He talks to the Ribbono Shel Olam. He conceived of the concept of sacrifices without having been told. He worked out the concept of korbanos, that one has to bring a korban, and he did it. In fact, he brought the sacrifice before Hevel. And I don't have it in front of me, but there's a beautiful Targum Yonasan, which says that when he saw that God didn't accept his sacrifice, the Targum Yonasan describes a dialogue between Hevel and Cain. And what emerges is Cain at the end of the dialogue says, you know what, Hevel? I don't believe that there's a Dayan, let's din. I don't believe there's justice. I don't believe there's a judge. I don't believe there's anything after death. I don't believe anyone's watching what I do. I don't believe there's anything at all. I believe that nobody created the world. Just evolved. And why not? How can a man who 1 minute is bringing a sacrifice to the Ribbono Shel Olam, after having talked to him and related to him and worked out himself that he's going to bring a sacrifice, the next minute is denying the existence of the Ribbono Shel Olam altogether? It's frightening. We think that we ourselves get beyond that level. We think that, you know, after battling, we're now at the level where there's no question about the Emunah. We believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's behind us. Then you go on to another level and something else is behind us. And onto another level and something else is behind us. We see that nothing's behind us. It's possible in 1 moment to fall right down to the levels of Kfirah, of denial of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Even if one was starting off as a Cain. And don't forget, Cain was the son of Odin and Chavah, who were the greatest people we've ever had. Look what household they were raised in, Cain and Hevel. Cain was no ordinary man. But something went wrong. And total despair drops to the bottom levels of civilization. Another example, not such a good example, but also, we're told that at the end of Amor, that there was this man who was the son of a Jewish woman and an Egyptian wife and an Egyptian father, who went out into the camp and started swearing at the Ribbono Shel Olam. What came over him? So there's quite a lot of discussion as to what came over him. The Mechilta says, and Rashi brings it, Mibes Dino Shel Moshe Yotzo Mechuyot. This was a man who planted his tent in the tribe of Dan. Of course, he was not a member of the tribe of Dan. So somebody from the tribe of Dan came and said, excuse me, yeah, this is only Dan people can pitch their tents. Yeah, this is, you better go to your, sorry? Your periods, right? Go to where you belong. This is not your place. And he challenged it, and they went to court. Okay, which court did they go to? To the Beis Din of Moshe Rabbeinu. Can you imagine standing in front of Moshe Rabbeinu having a case and you're prepared to take it to Beis Din? As if you're just making trouble, you're prepared to go to court. So Moshe Rabbeinu's court, can you imagine the experience of standing in front of Moshe Rabbeinu's court? The Yotzon Mechuyot. Moshe Rabbeinu listens to the case and he tells this man, you're wrong. Sorry, you must move your tent. Come back, swearing at the Ribbono Shel Olam. What went wrong with him? There seems to be cases here where people just all of a sudden lose a screw. And they go crazy, religiously, spiritually crazy. I think this has got a lot to do with suicide, by the way. We'll see in a moment. There's deep psychology in all these cases. There's another one. You know the story of Ruth. Where you've got Ruth and Orpah, both married to sons of Naomi. The sons die without leaving children. Naomi wants to go back to Israel. Ruth and Orpah follow her. So she pleads with them. She says, what's the point of coming back? You won't have a life, you won't have a social life, I've got no more sons for you to marry. What's the point of coming with me? And finally, after persuading them, and there's a lot of discussion backwards and forwards, and the two of them, Ruth and Orpah, talked with one voice, no, we're coming with you. So they were both also on a very high level. At the end of the whole thing, it says, Batishak Orpah lechamosa veRuth dovtava. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law and went, and Ruth cleaved to her. It's a frightening midrashim on this. There's a midrash that says that same night, Orpah got involved with hundreds of illicit sexual affairs, according to the Tanhuma, even including with animals. One minute she's hugging Ruth, and she's hugging Naomi, and she's saying, I want to come with you. I want to be Jewish. I want to live a life of holiness and purity. And Ruth and Naomi says, no, please, don't go back to there. And there's argument and tears, and they cry, and they hug in the kiss. And they finally part, and she drops to the levels of an animal. The same night, not even the next night. Back to the first part of the shift. The problem of this kind of modesty, view oneself simply as a reflection of the Ribbono Shel Olam. I'll give you one other example, by the way, from last week. The Golden Calf. People who had said, now to the nation, people who saw all the miracles that they saw, are standing at the foot of Har Sinai, have heard God Himself talking to Moshe. And in a minute, they're dancing around the Golden Calf. Now, that's your question. What the hell? In a moment, they're dancing around the Golden Calf. So much so that the Ribbono Shel Olam says to Moshe, Maher, Reid, hurry up and go down. Look what's happened. Why didn't God tell Moshe before it happened? Give him a chance. It happened so quickly. Maher, get down quickly. Look what they're doing. So it wasn't a slow deterioration, a slow dropping. It was overnight, in a moment. People who were on the height of highs, down on the depths of despair. The problem with this kind of modesty, where I'm just a reflection of the Ribbono Shel Olam, is very simple. What happens when the lights go off? What do you do then? If I'm just a reflection of the Ribbono Shel Olam, what do you do when the Ribbono Shel Olam is not shining its torch at you? It can happen. There's such a thing as Hester falling, there's such a thing as the Ribbono Shel Olam hiding for a period. What do you do then? This is what you do. These examples that we've just seen. Cain was a man with a living image. He wasn't as great as he was and as fine as he was, it was only provided people were watching and accepting. Provided he was getting feedback, provided he was... There is nothing more. There's nothing to wait for. There's total despair. When the total despair, when all I am is a reflection, when the light goes off and nobody can see me, then I'm nothing. then I just don't count, I don't exist. The same applies to the man who lost the case. Yeah. Moshe's rejected. I lost the case, I take it personally. Moshe, my leader, has rejected. The same with Naomi. They all follow situations of rejection, where Naomi says to the girl, please go back. Ruth says no, we'll examine that in a moment. Orpah takes that as a personal approach. She's turning me back after all I want to give her. After all she knows she means to me. She's telling me to go home, that means she doesn't want me. She takes it personally, there's rejection, and all I was the living image of Naomi. And now Naomi doesn't want me, so what have I got left in the world? What is this? There's despair, lacking, darkness. All these cases in the Chumash that we brought are cases following rejection. A person who lives as an image only, a person who sees himself as nothing more than an image, is a person who can see oneself as a reflection both ways. For reflection, or for beauty, you need the light to shine on you, and you need somebody to see you. If a thing is not just a reflection, if a thing is real, the sun doesn't need anybody to appreciate it. It's there, it's real, it's burning, it's hot, even if nobody sees it. If the moon somehow, if nobody notices the moon, there's a bit of pathos to that. Because the moon doesn't have anything except its look. And if nobody's looking at it, then the moon really has got nothing at all. So when you're merely a reflection, if you're only a reflection, you need light to shine on you, and you need somebody to be appreciating you. And if you regard yourself only as an image, and you don't get feedback, you don't get appreciation, there's despair, total blackness and darkness. That's what happens. What should happen? You're supposed to take a lesson from the moon. What does the moon do? That's Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, you can't see the moon. Why can't you see the moon? Because the sun isn't shining on it. The sun is hid itself for a moment. For a short period, the sun is not shining on it. What does the moon do? If the moon committed suicide, that would be the end of the moon. We wouldn't have a moon again. What would happen if the moon didn't even commit suicide, if the moon just said, I'm giving up? That's how the sun wants it. Okay, I stop here. Also would never see the moon again. What gives us a new month is the fact that that moon carries on. That's it. And it just moves a little bit further, and it's back in the sunlight. But if it would give up at that point, if it would stop at that point, we would have nothing. And what I want to look at very briefly is, what measure is it? What quality is it that makes you go on even in the dark, when there's nobody to appreciate you, when there's nobody to see you, when nobody can see you because there's no light shining on you, when things are down at the bottom, you haven't learned, you haven't heard anything interesting, you haven't been stimulated, you haven't been inspired, so there's nothing reflecting off, you feel despair, you feel at the bottom, depressed, miserable, nothing's happening. There's two choices at that point: to give up, just to stay where you are, or to just keep on slugging. Just to endure it. What is that middah that enables you to endure it? Now we have a definition of the middah of endurance, of belief. Why does the moon carry on moving? It knows that behind there, somewhere, there's still a sun. That's it. If I keep on going, it will find me again. Somewhere the sun still lives, it's not there. Now, a child in its early stages of development goes through a period where he thinks if he can't see something, it doesn't exist. That's the trauma that the child goes through when the mother leaves the child. It leaves the child from one room to another. At that moment, the child's vision, the mother doesn't exist at all. So every time the mother walks out of the child's room, as far as the child is concerned, that's like death. That's the end of mother. I have no mother anymore. And that's why it's a very important educational game to play, now you see, now you don't. You know, this I see game. The child must learn that you see something, and then it's gone, and then it comes back again. Still there even while you don't see it, and you must make very short periods of the thing being gone and slowly lengthen the period. The child gets to know that it doesn't matter even how long it's gone for. Stay and it will come back. So the ability to relate to something which can't be seen, or shall we say which can't be sensed, is the ability of anyone. Like the cynical Western fellow who says, I don't believe in God, prove it. Can't see him, can't hear him, can't touch him, can't smell him. Can't even prove it. Can't even rationalize God. Why should I believe in him? He doesn't understand what emunah is. A baby can't rationalize either that its mother is still there when the mother is next door. The baby can't see, feel, touch, hear, smell, nothing. What is it that teaches the baby after playing now you see, now you don't, that something exists even when you can't see? That's the beginning of the development of emunah in a child. The beginning of the development of the concept that things can exist even when you don't know that they're there. Know for sure. There's such a thing as chazaka. My Rosh Hashiva used to explain chazaka, the concept of the chazaka, very simply. If you're walking away from your house, you don't have to turn over your shoulder every moment to check that it's still there. When you left, it was there, the chances are it's still there. You don't have to worry, it's all okay. Sometimes I think that mothers suffer from a lack of emunah and a lack of, now you see it, now you don't know, than the babies do. Because when they're away, they phone a dozen times and they rush back home. And how's my little one? Is my little one still alive? And oh, what's happening at home? They can't understand. You left the baby sleeping quietly, the baby's still likely to be sleeping quietly. Might have woken up in the meantime and be sleeping again. But it will survive the period of separation. But sometimes the mother has to learn this, you know, now you see it, now you don't. The husband should play the game with the mother. Now you see, now you're there. Now you're done. Teach the mother that it doesn't matter if you move away a little bit. But this is really the concept of emunah, to know that there was a God. What, why do we mention Yetzias Mitzrayim so often? On Shabbos, in Kiddush, in Davening, in various brachos that we make. What is also important, you've got to know that there was a God who took us out of Mitzrayim, and he's still there. We haven't heard a big explosion. We haven't heard him disappear. We haven't seen him disappear. There's a chazaka. He was there, and nothing's happened to make us think that he's no longer there. So he's still there. On the contrary, if you look a little bit carefully, you see things every day, every moment, that prove that he's still there once you know. But the basic understanding that there's a God there is an ability of emunah, it's an emotional maturity which is required. It's not an intellectual thing, it's an emotional maturity to know that even when God's hiding behind someone, he's still there, doesn't matter. And that's what this keeps you plodding on. The man who commits suicide, Pastor Shaw, or who opts out, or who gets depressed, is a man who simply doesn't have any. He doesn't believe it will ever come right. Why won't it ever come right? Because the light goes. I told you the tragic story once, I think. I remember hearing the story of a little boy, it was very, very tragic. Apparently true. It was a man who was born blind. And as time went on, a technique was developed where his doctor felt that his eyesight could be restored with an operation. It was a tremendous build-up when to tell the story for a long, long time, building up how this young man was told about eyesight and what it means and how it is, and that shortly the technique will be perfected, and then he hears that the technique is perfected, and they're flying out the equipment or shipping out the equipment or whatever it was, and the doctors are converging. Finally the great day comes and he goes into the hospital, he has his operation, the doctors are satisfied it's successful, they bandage his eyes, and finally the day for unbandaging his eyes comes. Opens his eyes and he's completely over. The color, the brilliance of everything around him, the beauty of everything around him, everything he can see that it wasn't to be imagined. And he's in 7 seconds. He just couldn't imagine such happening. And after a while, his eyesight starts fading again. And it gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And he finished through. They forgot to tell him about night time. They forgot to tell him it gets dark. It's a terrible story and a tragic story, but that's what we're talking about. A man who thinks when it gets dark, it's never going to get light again, is a man who doesn't have any more. A man who thinks that when the Ribono Shel Olam is hiding away, he's never going to come out again, is a man who lacks the moon. It's important to know darkness, light, sun, scary, not important. The Ribono Shel Olam is there. That's what we learn from the moon, that's endurance. Keep going, it doesn't matter, there's no reflection, nobody can see you, nobody knows about you, you're anonymous, nobody cares about you. It doesn't matter. Can you imagine what that moon feels like? When people don't even know that there's a moon, they look up in the sky, there's a moon, no, it's finished. Your student says, not a moon, there is a moon, and the moon must be shouting, can't you see me? No, nobody even knows, nobody even cares. And then it carries on and on and on, and the next day you notice the moon again. And that's the meaning of the prophet Bernard. In the daytime, people tell of the chesed of the kindness of the Ribono Shel Olam because they're reflecting God's kindness all the time. But the emunot of balayla, in the nighttime it's emunah, in the nighttime it's trap. When things are dark, when things are bleak, when things are confused, the only thing that can keep you going then is emunah. You've got to believe that they're going to come right again. To say that another, that modesty is just believing that I am nothing but a reflection, is a very dangerous teaching. And that's unfortunately what has happened on many occasions with wrong musa being taught. I've often told you that musa is a very important experience, but the wrong people learning the wrong musa can be terribly dangerous. In fact, it can be almost suicidal. People can become so depressed by learning how they're really nothing that as long as they're feeling recognition, okay. In fact, it's more than that. this kind of modesty that we're talking about, which is a modesty which is often threatened. I am absolutely nothing. I am nothing at all. I'm just a reflection of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That kind of modesty is in fact arrogance. Because what it means basically is, I'm nothing on my own. I have no self-sufficiency. All I have is what you can see. And it becomes a superficial kind of arrogance. My whole life becomes one of images. I've got to portray a certain image. Because that's all I am. I'm only an image. And if there's nobody there to see me, I'm depressed and miserable. That's in fact an arrogance, and that's why the Gemara says in Sotah Daf Dalet that a person who is an arrogant, who is arrogant, a gas ruach, bav daivan, arrogant person, is like a kosher, is like a person who denies the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because an arrogant person, when nobody can see, when the light's not shining, he becomes miserable and he despairs. There's nothing in him besides that which people can see. Let us look at the other side then and say that modesty must be to be black, to not care about the image and the reflection. I absorb what I see and I learn what I hear and I take in everything I can, and that's it. That's all I care about, what I take in. Maybe it's modesty, maybe it's not, but one thing is ugliness. That's ugliness. Let's look at that for a moment. You might think, by the way, that I'm joking about this blackness as ugliness, and I don't want to be racial, but it's actually a medrash on this week's subject, which we'll do in a few moments. But basically, the Medrash quotes another pasuk in Shir HaShirim where it says, "Shchora ani v'na'ava," I am black and beautiful. After the Medrash, I had a friend that always used to ask him when people said that they are black and beautiful, or black is beautiful. You used to say, "Black is beautiful." You wouldn't have to tell me. But the Medrash asked an even stronger question. Listen to this: "In shchora lama na'ava, if black, how come beautiful? The chiyesh shchora na'ava, is there such a thing as black and beautiful?" We have to understand what this Medrash means, but the Medrash says clearly. But there's no such thing as being black and beautiful. Black is ugly. Black is a color which isn't beautiful. It's serious. But it's not beautiful. Now let's understand that. We said already that reflection, that beauty is created by reflectiveness. But let's take it even a little bit further. Beauty means that I have pleasure in having something, or in seeing something, in relating to something, although I don't need it. Right? If I say to you, I think the table is beautiful, that's why we keep it in the Beis HaMikdash. That's not true. We keep it in the Beis HaMikdash because we need a table. In addition to that, you think it's beautiful, that's fine, but the fact that it's there is not a sign that it's beautiful. A stepladder is a very important thing to have in a household. It's a very useful thing, and when you need it, you love it. But you don't leave it lying around in your lounge. Because when you don't need it, it's ugly. But a picture, a beautiful picture, even if you've got hundreds of pictures, you'll find a place for another one. Even if you don't need it, if it's beautiful, you'll relate to it and you'll take pleasure in it. What does constitute whether a thing is beautiful or not? Sometimes it's subjective beauty. I find something beautiful. I don't care if you do. I find it beautiful. That's not really beauty. That means it's a personal subjective thing that I relate to in this way. It appeals to me. I sympathize with it. Real beauty is something which impresses most people with its beauty. That's really what it is. I'll give you a simple example. You can have a man and a husband and a wife sitting at a dinner party, and he ignores her the whole evening. He nods to her and ignores her. All of a sudden, the man sitting nearby her starts taking an interest in her, and he starts talking to her and offering her things and flattering her, and all of a sudden you find that the husband is taking an interest in her. What's happened? Two things are happening. The one thing is he's worried. The other thing, which is actually the more correct thing, and I'll show you in a moment why we know that it's the more correct thing, is he suddenly realizes, if he finds her attractive, why should I be looking for other women? Why should I be turned off? That means she must be attractive. The din is part of the din of dancing in front of a bride at a wedding. The din is the mitzvah is not to dance in front of the chotan, by the way. The mitzvah is to dance in front of the bride, in front of the kalam. That her husband should love her. I don't know, the wedding day, okay, 10 years later I can understand you dancing in front of her. But on the wedding day, surely they wouldn't be getting married if he doesn't love her? Yes, he loves her, but he thinks all the time, maybe it's just my infatuation. Maybe I love her because I'm in love. Who says that in 20 years' time, in 50 years' time, when we're both old and hobbling around, who says I'll still love her? And when he sees hundreds of people dancing in front of her and happy and smiling and praising her, how beautiful she is, he realizes that it's not just subjective. He realizes that she generally seems to create a nice impression on people, and he convinces himself that she's really someone worthwhile and she's really beautiful. Beauty. One feels beauty. One's confident about beauty when it makes a beautiful impression on other people. That's when you know that it's really beautiful. The fact that I like it is not a sign that it's beautiful. When everybody says how beautiful it is, that's a sign that it's beautiful. I'll give you another example from this week's schedule. The kiyor was made from copper. What copper was it made from? You remember we've often spoken about the Rashi over there. It was made from the mirrors. They used to use copper as mirrors that the women used to use to do themselves up. And Moshe didn't want to take it. Well, mirrors that the women used to do themselves up and make themselves look beautiful again, to make something in the Beit HaMikdash out of those mirrors. And the Rebbeinu Shlom says, I prefer this to anything else that's been brought, any other raw material. Because when the Jews were in Egypt, when the Jews were in Mitzrayim, and they were slaving away and they were working hard, there was a danger that they would be so tired that procreation would cease. And these women used to do themselves up, and they used to go and they used to sit with their husbands during a break. And they used to joke, they used to look at the mirror and they used to show their husbands, look, I'm more beautiful than you, and look how ugly you are, and look how pretty I am. Why do they need the mirrors for that? Why don't you sit with the mirror with your husband and say, look what a crooked nose you've got and what a pretty nose I've got. Look what ugly eyes you've got and look what pretty eyes I've got. Why do you have to look in the mirror? Just to show the husband your face, that's subjective. What the women are saying to him, and subjective one takes for granted. Subjective, you like your wife, okay, but that doesn't mean that you're attracted by her beauty. You're attracted by her as a person, and she's there today and she'll be there tomorrow, and you can take her for granted altogether. But when she takes out the mirror and she says to him, look, what she's trying to say is forget about me. Look how other people see me. Just look at me as a woman, not as your wife. Just as a woman. Aren't I pretty? And then one ceases to look at it in terms of the personality, with the flaws of the personality, with the way she shouted at you last night, with the way she was looking not so, so beautiful as she's looking tonight, as the way she was last night, remembering her hair and curls, all that kind of thing, with the tears all of a sudden, because you're not looking at her. You're looking at the impression she creates. And you notice this. That's why very often husbands carry around pictures of their wife. Why don't you have a picture of your wife if you see her every day? It's a very good idea to have a picture of her. Because that's how other people see her. And only too often one doesn't look at one's wife the way other people see her. That's the example of the dinner party. When somebody else looks at her, then you suddenly notice that she's in fact physical. We like to take things for granted. Everything we've got is ordinary. What other people have got is fantastic. Our home is ordinary. What other people have got is fantastic. Our motor car is ordinary. What other people have got, that's fantastic. My job is ordinary. What other people have got is fantastic. You always look at what other people have got, because you look at that without seeing the flaws. You look at that only the beautiful part. You look at the impression it creates. And of course everybody designs themselves to create an impressive impression. Of course everybody makes out that they're terribly happy. Of course everybody makes out that they're on top of the world, and we fall for it. And if one would just look at oneself the way other people see one would realize that you can be jealous of yourself as well. To be impressed by beauty, one has to be impressed by the reflection, by the impression the beauty creates on others, not by looking directly at the person. And therefore, blackness, somebody who doesn't respond, just has it. I said, it might be modest, I don't know, but it's ugly. Somebody, you tell them something they get, you never hear it coming out again. They read something, they absorb it. You give them something, they take it. You never get feedback, nothing comes back, nothing's reflected. That's ugly, that's black. What's another? What's modesty? What's a midah of smallness that we're meant to learn from the moon? Says the Midrash, Shchoira ani v'nava, I'm black and beautiful. Up the Midrash is Shchoira lana nava, but yes, Shchoira nava. How can you be black and beautiful? Ela omra Knesset Yisrael, but Knesset Yisrael answers, Shchoira ani b'ma'asai, I'm black in my actions. V'nava ani b'ma'asai v'etam. If you look at my ancestors' actions, I'm beautiful. Shchoira ani b'mitzrayim, I'm black in Egypt. V'nava ani b'ma'asina. But standing at Mount Sinai, I'm beautiful. Shoyrani alayam, at the sea I'm ugly, I'm black. The Navani the only Zekeli Van Vey. But when I say Zekeli Van Vey, this is my God and I shall adorn him, then I'm beautiful. Shoyrani the Master Haiga, I'm black when I made the calf, the Navani the Master HaMishkan, and I'm beautiful when I made the Mishkan. What's that all about? Are you black or are you beautiful? How do you answer the question? There are two kinds of blackness, and that's what the Midrash is telling you. There's a kind of blackness where your color is black. And that means even when you shine a light on you, you don't affect anything. That's the kind of blackness which is inherently ugly. A person who doesn't reflect, a person who takes without giving back, a person who earns without spending, a person who learns without teaching, a person who receives without giving, that's a black hole. Shchoira, just takes and takes and takes and nothing can come out of it. Shchoira, black, ugly. There can be nothing beautiful about it, whatever. But there's another kind of blackness. And that's the blackness that you have in the last world.
That's the essence of modesty and the essence of peace. And that's what the Medici said. Shchayro ani b'masai. If you look at me, I'm black, but why? Not because I'm black in color. Because you, Ribbono Shel'Olam, are shining a light on me. That's why. Look at my father. Look at Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. When you used to talk to them, when they used to be with them, when they used to experience you and know you on a day-to-day basis, were they also black? So you can see that I'm not black by color by looking at my ancestry, where I come from. I'm white. But if you turn off the light of Ribbono Shel'Olam, what do you expect? That's Emuna. I'm black now, I'm dark now, but not inherently dark. Can you imagine when the Jews were being led to the gas chamber, knowing that they're not the only ones going to the gas chamber? They're there in their hundreds. Not just in their hundreds, but they were there yesterday and the day before and last month and the month before, every day, hundreds and thousands. And they must have made the calculation themselves. How many Jews are there in the gas? At what speed are they being killed off? Everybody, the Rosh Hashivas are gone, the Rabbonim are gone, the Yeshivas are destroyed, the libraries are destroyed, the Torim are destroyed, there are no books, there are no Gemaras, there are no Rosh Hashivas, there are no Talmidim, there are no Chavrusim, there's nothing. And what do they do when the way to get them? Ani ma'amin be'emun ha'shleim of the Viyas HaMashiach. I believe the full belief in the coming of the Mashiach. A German who would have understood what they were saying would have looked at him and said, that's absolutely insane. It doesn't matter how dark it is. Don't give up. If you look at me now, maybe I'm black, but that's because the lights aren't on. But now if you look at me in essence, if you look at who I really am, turn the lights on and see. Then you see I'm not black. And so he goes on. Shoyla ani b'Mitzrayim. Judge me in Egypt. Of course I was black in Egypt. Of course I was in the depths of despair. Of course I wasn't performing the way I should have performed. Of course I wasn't doing the mitzvahs I should have been doing. But the lights weren't on. I had no light. I had no input. Look at me at Har Sinai, just 49 days later. And there I rise to the levels of Nisei V'Nishma, I rise to angelic levels of being able to accept the Torah. Why? Because in essence I'm not black, the light is turned on. Moshe disappears, and I think to myself, what chance have I got now? My only chance of coming out was through Moshe, and Moshe was going to teach me. And now Moshe has rejected me. He's opted to stay on the mountain. That's what it means when they saw Moshe dead. Didn't just mean that they saw the thought that he died. Because then you appoint somebody else. We asked that last time. You remember last week. Why didn't they just appoint somebody else? The concept of Moshe dying wasn't just that Moshe had died. The concept was that Moshe rejected them and chose rather to stay on the mountain with the Rebbeinu Shlomo. That's what they were worried about. That feeling of rejection is turning the lights off. So what is there? What does it all mean? An ego, an eyeball, dance around it, sing around it, get drunk, forget yourself. What's that solution? Just Moshe said. But when you've got a situation of making the Mishkan, and you ask me to use that same artistic ability that I used to make the top. But you direct me, Ribbono Shel'Olam. You tell me what to do. You're there. You're shining. That's a different thing to do. Here we have the exact balance between, which creates another and experience modesty and which creates beauty. To know that what I have, not that I'm nothing without you. I'm something. I'm capable of reflecting anything you'll give me. That's what it is. That's what one has to know, that I'm a material capable of reflecting. Ribbono Shel Olam, give me something to reflect and I'll reflect it. Shine on me and I'll give it back. Teach me something and I'll use it. Show me something and I'll integrate it and I'll develop it. Do a kindness to me and I'll do 100 kindnesses back. Give me a parnosa and I'll give tzedakah. Give me a home and I'll have visitors and guests. Give me a wife and I'll raise a family. That's what tefillah is. That's what praying to the Ribbono Shel Olam is. And that's what another is. Just give me something and see what I do with it. Anything is done like this, when one's got to that level, when something is shone at one, to catch it and reflect it, to notice that one's receiving from it. And contrary wise, when one's in a position of darkness, which happens, it happens to reconfirm our novice, to reconfirm our modesty. And one finds oneself in a situation of darkness, to know that there's a need. Darkness, why the darkness? It's a light stop for a few minutes. It's night time, and we're not for ballet, but the light will go on again. It's not serious. But I've got to keep going. If I stop here, that's the end, then I'll never see the light again. Why is the light turned off? Just to see whether I keep going without the light. And I've got to show that I can keep going. I'm miserable. I'm depressed. I don't know what it's all about. I don't know what it's all for. But there's some meaning somewhere. There's some purpose somewhere. And I'm going to go, step by step, groping around in the dark. If I fall, I'll pick myself up again and I'll move on. Because by moving, I'm going to find that light. Then one's able to say of oneself, Yoyer Hashem, Elecha, Yahweh Hashem, Elecha, Yahweh Hashem, follow Elecha, may the Ribbono Shel Olam shine his face on me. That's what the bracha is. May the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's all we need. Once the Ribbono Shel Olam is shining his face on us, we can show him that we are Nava, we are beautiful in essence. We're only Shechorim, we're only black when there's no light. And when he shines his face on us, then we're able to respond with beauty and with perfection. What would Heather be? It's Chaim, just imagine. If Chaim would have waited a few days. Don't get angry. Just hang on and see. The Ribbono Shel Olam hasn't rejected you. He just wanted a better korban, that's all. He threw light at you and you didn't reflect it properly. If we take the case of the man who came out of the Beis Din. Just wait your favorite Shabbos to Moshe after Shul next time and you'll see you've got nothing personal against you. You see, he didn't reject you. With Aaron and the Egypt, with the people in the golden calf. Wait one day if they would have waited. Just keep going. Okay, Moshe's gone, but keep going. One day it would have been solved. And you're the same with Ruth. She says, the Ruth does cover. I don't care. You don't want me. You don't care for me. I don't care. You're rejecting me. That doesn't matter. I'm carrying on.